back. This is Dollars and Change. With thanks to Danielle for giving us a little music to bop to.
Getting jazzed.
You know, one day we're going to okay, enough with this social impact stuff. That is not true. We're just going to have to add to our repertoire, a music show.
Perhaps we'll do the social impact of music business.
I saw, okay, we're going to get to the substance of this, but I might have looked at Facebook. Said earlier, I saw this crazy thing, Nick. This was dance your PhD dissertation. It was
sign me up.
It was the goof. So there's an award for this. This is this goofiest thing. And as far as I can tell, like one of them, it was just like, oh my god, it was right. Dance your PhD dissertation. Like, what would I, Catherine Klein, be more interested in?
You did yours on employee stock ownership, right?
Yeah, God. Yeah,
so is it interpretive? Images in my head now.
I have no idea how I think. My dissertation was a long time ago, but it was on employee stock ownership. There was a tango, this remarkable tango performance of a physics PhD. Like, all I can remember was protons dividing or something of the sort. So anyway.
Okay.
Anyway, all right. So we're not talking about Dance Your PhD, but it was kind of interesting, your PhD dissertation. We are back on Dollars and Change, talking about social impact of business, talking about all sorts of challenges that we face in the world and ways in which
things that pop up on your Facebook feed and things that probably don't pop up on mine. That's now where my head is.
That's now where your head is. I know you, Nick Ashburn. I know you like to dance, too.
I do like to dance.
So, so we might have to bring this to you. In this segment, we're going to be continuing our conversation with the folks from the KPOR Center, the broad umbrella organization doing fascinating work out in California. And I am delighted to welcome Eli Kennedy to the program, CEO of the Level Playing Field Institute and also a Wharton alum. I'll put in a plug. Eli, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Catherine. Yeah, proud 2004 graduate.
Excellent. Great to have you with us. So let's start there. 2004, 12 years ago, how does somebody go, from being a Wharton MBA alum, right?
Yeah.
To the work you're doing with the Level Playing Field Institute. This is not, we know a lot of people are going into, I don't know what the biggest employers are coming out of Wharton. I probably should know that, but, one hears a lot about McKinsey and Goldman Sachs. And sometimes, larger other companies these days, Apple and Google as well. What was your path that brought you to the Level Playing Field?
Yeah, so when I went into Wharton, I knew I wanted to pivot a little bit and to do the doing good and doing well at the same time.
We love that. That's why you came to Wharton. You didn't come to Wharton because, I wanted to make a lot more money over. That was my most important criterion.
No, it was really about, sort of giving back and doing some, doing some good in the world. My mom was a teacher for all of her career.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have this sort of interest in education. While I was there at Wharton, actually, I took a class called Urban Fiscal Policy. I don't know if Peter Inman is still there.
Yeah,
That class really shaped a lot of my thinking in terms of how I would focus my efforts.
I've heard that before on this show.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Must be an impactful class.
Yeah.
It's a great class. I mean, it really just talked about a city and all the challenges that a policy or that an administration faces in a city. And all of the long-term solutions were all about education. So how do you solve crime if you have a higher, a better educated populace? How do you improve the economy, a better educated populace? So it was really that class that helped me sort of shape my vision for what I wanted to do. That's sort of how I used Wharton to pivot. And really one of the great things about the school was the size of the class was I wasn't a total unicorn within my class. There were sort of 20 or 30 other people that were looking to go into nonprofits and who are out there doing wonderful things in the world. So.
Right. And that I will tell you and I tell our listeners that the portion of the student body that is really interested in using their business knowledge and skills to make a positive difference, whether in nonprofits or impact investing or in mainstream companies, entrepreneurship. That's a really sizable chunk of the population these days.
20 to 25% of the incoming MBA class.
Yeah, at least. Yeah, I would say maybe even higher. Right. We see them. We see them reaching out to the Wharton Social Impact Initiative when they get here. We see they're attending. We see them taking classes, really exploring how to have a career in this space. So let's talk about what you're doing. You're with the Level Playing Field Institute. Tell our listeners what is the mission of the Level Playing Field Institute?
So our mission is to eliminate the barriers facing people from underrepresented communities, particularly within the K-12 space, in terms of preparing them to go into STEM majors within college and then going on into STEM careers.
So let's make sure that our listeners actually know what STEM is. What is STEM and why is this important?
It's science, technology, engineering, and math. And the reason it's so important is that basically all of the growth within the economy, all the job growth, is being driven by these types of jobs.
Yeah, certainly a lot of it, or maybe we would say a lot of the job growth, particularly for higher paying jobs, right? Because there's certainly service. And we hear a lot about healthcare. We hear a lot about home healthcare as a growing segment of the population as well, jobs. But they're not, to date, they do not play like a STEM job would.
Right. And increasingly, the sort of entry level position into the higher level paying jobs is really based on STEM skills. Another key point.
And so you're trying to make sure that access to those jobs is open to which groups? Which groups needs particular support getting access to those kinds of jobs?
Yeah. So if we look at low income communities and the public schools that they're in, they just aren't getting the same level of education when it comes to science, technology, engineering, and math. There are massive teacher shortages. There are real gaps in terms of just sort of facility quality. But basically, these folks are really being put at a disadvantage because they don't get the education in the school day that they need to be competitive in getting into top colleges and then succeeding beyond that. So specifically, we're focused on low-income communities, African-Americans, and Latinos.
Yeah. And as your name suggests, you are hoping to level the playing field and then to mix our metaphors here to sort of increase the pipeline of low-income kids and underrepresented minorities who are making it to, who are ready to get and are getting a STEM education and STEM jobs. So I know that one of your most successful and interesting programs is to do this, to make a difference in this space is SMASH.
Correct.
What is SMASH?
So SMASH is an acronym that stands for the Summer Math and Science Honors Academy. What we do is we work with universities to prepare high school students to succeed at those universities. So we take students, they come to us after their freshman year of high school. They come to us for a 5-week summer intensive program where we build their STEM skills. We work on their leadership and public speaking skills. We do a lot of exposure into STEM industries. That's one place where a lot of folks from low-income communities don't have people within their network that work in STEM jobs. So we do speaker series and networking nights. And then the kids really, or the scholars, I should say, really build a network of other folks that they can lean on. So they come to that 5-week academy, and they do that actually each of their 3 years of high school. So they come back to us their sophomore and junior years. In addition to the summer programming, we do academic year programming. So once or twice a month, the students will come and we'll do field trips to companies, and we have a computer science course. So in addition to the summer programming, the academic year programming, we give the students total about 1,000 hours of supplemental education, really designed to give them the skills that they need to succeed in college.
And what kind of outcomes are you seeing from these programs? How do you measure? We hear a lot about measuring impact. What do you see?
Yeah, so the primary way we measure our impact is college entry. And we are now seeing about 95% of our students go into 4-year colleges. About half of our students go into top 50 colleges, so the top 1% of colleges in the nation. And about 75% of the students go on to STEM majors, which is 3 times the rate that you're seeing nationally.
So I'm betting that folks are out here listening to you talk and are thinking, oh, that Eli Kennedy guy, CEO of the Level Playing Field Institute, weaving in a reminder of who we're talking with in case you're just joining us. That's really interesting. I want my kid to have this kind of opportunity. So tell us more when we talk about SMASH. Who are these kids? How are they getting in? And where are your programs?
Yeah, so we have 5 universities that we're currently partnered with. 3 are clustered in the larger Bay Area. So we have a partnership with Cal, Stanford, and UC Davis. We have 1 program in Los Angeles, which is UCLA. And we have a program at Morehouse College in Atlanta.
And we've been talking about something here at Penn. I don't know where the latest conversation is, but I can't speak for Wharton, but I sure like the idea of bringing Smash here too.
I am extremely hopeful. We're deep in conversation, so I'm extremely hopeful.
That is great. And who are the kids who get in, and how do they get in?
When we first enter a city, basically we have an internal research department, and they'll go out and identify schools that are of the highest need. So these are schools where the students don't have the resources in the day. They are schools that are largely free and reduced lunch. They are schools that do not have computer science courses. So we identify schools that have the highest need, where we really can sort of change the trajectory of a student by bringing them into our program. So we identify those schools. We do a bunch of outreach to teachers, guidance counselors, if they exist at those schools, and a bunch of other marketing. The students then apply to us, and we take about a quarter of the students that actually apply. The application process itself is a very complicated process. It's a lot like a college application, essays, interviews, a test. So that's sort of our vetting process. And our pool of students ends up being about 80% free and reduced lunch, about 75% first-generation college students, about half men and half women, about 26% African-American, about 50% Latino, and the bulk of the rest are mixed race, identify as mixed race.
So, Eli, this is Nick. I'm curious to know, given those sort of demographics, going back to the broader challenge around just diversity in the STEM fields and getting students interested in this, you know, from your experience, is it a matter of not just having the technical skills, but is it also exposure, that these are accessible careers for folks from these communities?
Absolutely. One of the big challenges is a lot of these folks aren't aware of what any of those STEM careers look like. So, you know, as they're planning their lives, we have a lot of students who are aware of kind of the very traditional careers, doctor, lawyer, teacher, but aren't familiar with what a computer science engineer is and what that looks like every day. So we do a lot of work in, one, sort of making them aware of what those careers are, two, showing them people that look like the students, like look like our scholars, who can show them that they can actually make it and they can do it. You know, they give them the confidence that this is a path that's accessible to them. We put a lot of work also, and again, in like really building a network so that they have folks that they can lean on. Like, remember, these students are in schools where they often aren't around folks who have similar ambition to them, and are often around other students who aren't interested in STEM and don't know about it. So having a network of 30 folks that you know really, really well, that you can lean on when you're thinking about AP classes or your career or your major or what schools you want to apply to, is tremendously valuable to these scholars.
You know, I'm just going to throw in a personal story, because it hit me recently. I don't know what exactly made me think of this, right? But, you know, here I am in my 50s for a while longer, and a professor at Wharton. You know, a career that never anticipated when I was growing up. And I was struck. I actually viscerally remember, I think I must have been in fifth or sixth grade, growing up in Silicon Valley before it was Silicon Valley, to be clear, you know, and in a well-to-do family. And some teacher must have asked us what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I remember sort of feeling frozen. Like, I cannot imagine what I want to be when I grow up. And clearly the implication was, what job do you want when you grow up? And the only job that I could think of was a babysitter. That was it. You know, I had no vision for being anything else. I couldn't imagine. Like, what did women do? What did girls do? They were babysitters. That was it. That's what I could imagine. You know, and slowly but surely, but really very slowly, my eyes opened. And even as we have this conversation, I'm thinking, God, when I was growing up, like, when, it'd be actually quite interesting, when did the term entrepreneur enter the vocabulary, even the thought that one could be an entrepreneur, what an entrepreneur was, you know? So this, no, I say this because I'm not an underrepresented minority. I'm not an African American kid. I'm not a low income kid. But this was my experience as a child, and you know, for me, it was a powerful memory when I went back to it. Eli, we're also hearing about some of the other strategies that you all are using in the Level Playing Field Institute, and we're hearing about hackathons. So yet another new term in the vocabulary, less familiar than entrepreneur. So what's a hackathon, and why has this been an interesting approach for you all to try to use as you pursue your larger mission?
So a hackathon is primarily a big exposure event. So it's an event that you have over a couple days where you'll sort of throw out a problem or a design that you want a group of folks to come up with. And they'll work together across the period of a day or a couple days to design a solution to a problem or to design something new. So it's also called design thinking. It's a really powerful environment for a student to come in and be exposed to something, work on a team, get to learn about new technology, get to really think through with others of different experiences about solutions. So it's a really powerful event for folks to come in and do and learn about tech and learn about STEM initiatives. One of the things that's kind of interesting that we've done that's happened with us, I guess, over time is that we've had scholars who actually have sat in a hackathon and come up with an idea for an app, come back to our program within Smash and sort of built on some of their computer skills, and then gone on actually to another sort of coding boot camp that actually could help them really design this app. And they eventually took an idea that they birthed in a hackathon and actually built it now to where it's actually on the App Store, the Apple App Store, like brought that into reality.
Yeah.
So sort of entrepreneurship in its purest form.
And Eli, did I read somewhere that one of your recent hackathons actually was 70% women or girls?
Quite possible. So there are, across the K4 set of family of organizations, there are a number of different hackathons that go on. So there are things that are themed that actually were, I think you were just talking to Cedric Brown, mm-hmm. Sort of under his organization. So that's quite possibly the case. I don't think one of ours was 70% female.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Exciting. So, you know, Eli, we've been talking about the work you do at the Level Playing Field Institute, but you know, we started this segment talking about your experiences at Wharton, and certainly I know a lot of our, you know, a lot of the students we talk with are interested in social impact careers of some kind. How is it that you talk to us about how your MBA education, your business background, you know, shapes what you do and your effectiveness at the Level Playing Field Institute?
I think it's interesting. I use a lot of the skills that I learned at Wharton on a daily basis. And I think there's an interesting misconception, I think, when people think about nonprofits, that it's all sort of relationship-based and very sort of social in nature. But in fact, I mean, all of the good nonprofits that you're seeing these days are run like companies. So they're really run with the discipline that companies are run with. So all of those sort of managerial skills that are key to running a successful company are essential to running a nonprofit. You need to be innovative. You need to build an organizational culture. You need to manage a budget. You need to be thoughtful about strategy. So all of those skills that I really developed at Wharton and early in my career are things that I bring to bear at LPFI. So specifically, I mean, we're in the midst of an existing strategy and sort of going about that. But very shortly, we're going to be considering an additional strategy to even broaden our impact. And that's where really a lot of the sort of strategic thinking and strategic frameworks that I learned at Wharton will really come to bear.
So fascinating, intriguing. So we're talking with Eli Kennedy, CEO of the Level Playing Field Institute. Can you talk with us about some of the strategies you're considering, or, you know, even just the goals? What are the goals and challenges that you are seeing that are making you think, I gather, you know, we're doing good work, we need to do more, we can do something else as well?
So one of the challenges we face, I guess, within Smash is just scale, right? So our model is entirely built around having an extremely deep investment, deep relationship with a student, investing a considerable amount of resources and really propelling their trajectory. The constraint there is funding and resources to actually impact more than, you know, what we're doing now, which is hundreds of students, and we'll soon be at thousands of students, but would love to get to a significantly larger number than that. So strategically, the question we'll ask ourselves is there a way for us to, either using technology or existing educational structures, is there a way for us to expand our impact in a way where we can reach tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of students? And there's a lot of energy around that type of scale from philanthropy, particularly philanthropy that sort of st- stems from technology.
Yeah, I got to say, when I teach social impact classes and what you've just described really resonates. So, you all run SMASH, as you described, the Summer Math and Science Honors Program, and have this very, high-touch, in-depth interaction with the kids who come through your program, right? You said they're there every summer after high school. So after your freshman year of high school, after your sophomore year of high school, after your junior year of high school, and you're following through. I remember having conversations in class about sort of a depth strategy or a breadth strategy. And it's a really interesting, challenge in the space when you're trying to solve these social problems. Should we go deep? Really move the being, because as you said, you have pretty remarkable outcomes for the kids who come through your program, but you can't, but you can't reach as many kids as you might with a breadth strategy. I think the challenge with a breadth strategy is this is good. Maybe we achieve breadth, but with no real, we touch a lot of people, but we don't really change their lives.
Right.
So how are you thinking about the challenge of depth versus breadth and how you might actually change outcomes with a strategy that allows you to go to get that scale, to get that breadth?
Mm-hmm. So we look at, right now we're doing two things. So one is just making sure that we understand where there's a gap out there, where there's a real need for a solution. A couple places where we know there's real need is we know that there's massive computer science shortages in what's happening in urban schools. So in California, obviously, which is one of the most tech-rich industry states in the nation, only 2% of the schools that have the highest percentage of African-American and Latinos actually offer an AP computer science course. So there's this massive gap in computer science education. So we'll look at that and say, okay, there's a need for someone to step in there, and then we'll ask ourselves, this is sort of, to use an old framework, a SWOT analysis,
mm-hmm.
What are our strengths? Do we have things that we can build in that can help fill that need? So that's sort of the beginning of the analysis, is that question of just sort of, is there a need out there, and what do we have? Are there assets that we can leverage to fulfill that need?
Yeah.
And then from there, we get into the more sort of operational questions, and we'll do more analysis to understand how, what can we do, essentially? What would be the path to doing this, and what resources would be required to do so?
Right.
To follow on that example, one thing, we're, again, currently offering a computer science course. One of the things that we're really good at is sort of making the class itself, a computer science class, culturally relevant to our students. So there's, an opportunity or an asset that we can build on that might be really, really beneficial to an existing school system who's trying to participate in a CS for All initiative or just dramatically increase the portion of their students who are in computer science.
So, Eli, I think this probably needs to be our last question here as time is flying by. But, given your work as CEO of the Level Playing Field Institute, what misconception do people have about STEM careers and interest in STEM careers? What misconception would you like to correct about the kids you work with, STEM in general?
A quick anecdote is, we heard an executive from a prominent technology company sort of describe to us what they're looking for the other day. And they were saying, we're looking for this person who has been, taught themselves to code off YouTube and has sort of been in their basement building fantastic stuff. Someone that sounds sort of like Goodwill Hunting, right? Like they're just trying to trip over this person that is this genius out there who's just this diamond in a rough genius who can come in and code. But the reality is the person they're hiring isn't Goodwill Hunting. It's a person who went to a really affluent school, and they've had thousands and thousands of hours of supplemental education, were learning robotics when they were 6 years old. So I guess the main misconception I'd like to correct is that it's not that there's so much investment that goes into someone that actually enters a STEM career. It's not just sort of the pure genius or the pure intellect that's behind it. So I think sometimes when even professors or professionals encounter a person of color that's coming in, they say, they're just evaluating them and saying, look, this person just doesn't quite have it. And in some cases, in many cases, these students just need to have had the same educational experiences that the programmer from an affluent community has had.
Yeah. Eli, thanks so much for being with us. We need to close out this show. Great to have you with us. Eli Kennedy, CEO of the Level Playing Field Institute. Thanks to my co-host, Nick Ashburn, our sound engineer, Danielle Bruno, associate producer, Dion Simpkins, producer Matt Johnson, program director Patty Hall, and a great lineup of guests this week, as usual. This is Dollars and Change.